They began to go through the classifieds. He ran his finger down one column and then another. He passed quickly over the jobs available section. She saw checks beside a couple of things, but she didn't look to see what he'd marked. It didn't matter. There was a column headlined, Outdoor Camping Supplies. Then they found it. Appliances, new and used. Here, she said, and put her finger down on the paper. He moved her finger.
Let me see, he said.
She put her finger back where it had been.
Refrigerators, ranges, washers, dryers, etc., she said, reading from the ad boxed in the column. Auction barn. What's that, auction barn?
She went on reading.
New and used appliances and more every Thursday night. Auction at 7 o'clock. That's today. Today's Thursday, she said. This auction's tonight. And this place is not very far away. It's down on Pine Street. I must have driven by there 100 times. You too. You know where it is. It's down there close to that Baskin Robbins.
Her husband didn't say anything. He stared at the ad. He brought his hand up and pulled at his lower lip with two of his fingers.
Auction barn, he said.
She fixed her eyes on him.
Let's go to it. What do you say? It'll do you good to get out, and we'll see if we can't find us a fridge. Two birds with one stone, she said.
I've never been to an auction in my life, he said. I don't believe I want to go to one now.
Come on, Sandy said. What's the matter with you? They're fun. I haven't been to one in years, not since I was a kid. I used to go to them with my dad.
She suddenly wanted to go to this auction very much.
Your dad, he said.
Yeah, my dad.
She looked at her husband, waiting for him to say something else, the least thing. But he didn't.
Auctions are fun, she said.
They probably are, but I don't want to go.
I need a bed lamp, too,
she went on. They'll have bed lamps.
Hey, we need lots of things, but I don't have a job, remember?
I'm going to this auction, she said, whether you go or not. You might as well come along, but I don't care. If you want the truth, it's immaterial to me, but I'm going.
I'll go with you. Who said I wouldn't go?
He looked at her and then looked away. He picked up the paper and read the ad again.
I don't know the first thing about auctions, but sure, I'll try anything once. Whoever said anything about us buying an icebox at an auction?
Nobody, she said, but we'll do it anyway.
Okay, he said.
Good, she said, but only if you really want to.
He nodded. She said, I guess I'd better start cooking.
I'll cook the goddamn pork chops now and we'll eat, and the rest of this stuff can wait. I'll cook everything else later, after we go to this auction. But we have to get moving. The paper said 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, he said.
He got up from the table and made his way into the living room, where he looked out the bay window for a minute. A car passed on the street outside. He brought his fingers up to his lip. She watched him sit down on the sofa and take up his book. He opened it to his place. But in a minute he put it down and lay back on the sofa. She saw his head come down on the pillow that lay across the arm of the sofa. He adjusted the pillow under his head and put his hands behind his neck. Then he lay still. Pretty soon she saw his arms move down to his sides. She folded the paper. She got up from the chair and went quietly out to the living room, where she looked over the back of the sofa. His eyes were shut. His chest seemed to barely rise and then fall. She went back to the kitchen and put a frying pan on the burner. She turned the burner on and poured oil into the pan. She started frying pork chops. She'd gone to auctions with her dad. Most of those auctions had to do with farm animals. She seemed to remember her dad was always trying to sell a calf, or else buy one. Sometimes there'd be farm equipment and household items at the auctions, but mostly it was farm animals. Then, after her dad and mom had divorced, and she'd gone away to live with her mom, her dad wrote to say he missed going to auctions with her. The last letter he wrote to her, after she'd grown up and was living with her husband, he said he'd bought a peach of a car at this auction for $200. If she'd been there, he said, he'd have bought one for her, too. 3 weeks later, in the middle of the night, a telephone call told her that he was dead. The car he'd bought leaked carbon monoxide up through the floorboards and caused him to pass out behind the wheel. He lived in the country. The motor went on running until there was no more gas in the tank. He stayed in the car until somebody found him a few days later. The pan was starting to smoke. She poured in more oil and turned on the fan. She hadn't been to an auction in 20 years, and now she was getting ready to go to one tonight. But first, she had to fry these pork chops. It was bad luck their fridge had gone fluey, but she found herself looking forward to this auction. She began missing her dad. She even missed her mom now, though the two of them used to argue all the time before she met her husband and began living with him. She stood at the stove, turning the meat, and missing both her dad and her mom. Still missing them, she took a potholder and moved the pan off the stove. Smoke was being drawn up through the vent over the stove. She stepped to the doorway with the pan and looked into the living room. The pan was still smoking, and drops of oil and grease jumped over the sides as she held it. In the darkened room, she could just make out her husband's head and his bare feet. "Come on out here," she said. "It's ready."
"Okay," he said.
She saw his head come up from the end of the sofa. She put the pan back on the stove and turned to the cupboard. She took down a couple of plates and put them on the counter. She used her spatula to raise one of the pork chops. Then she lifted it onto a plate. The meat didn't look like meat. It looked like part of an old shoulder blade or a digging instrument. But she knew it was a pork chop, and she took the other one out of the pan and put that on a plate, too. In a minute, her husband came into the kitchen. He looked at the fridge once more, which was standing there with its door open, and then his eyes took in the pork chops. His mouth dropped open, but he didn't say anything. She waited for him to say something, anything, but he didn't. She put salt and pepper on the table and told him to sit down. "Sit down," she said, and gave him a plate on which lay the remains of a pork chop. "I want you to eat this," she said. He took the plate, but he just stood there and looked at it. Then she turned to get her own plate. Sandy cleared the newspaper away and shoved the food to the far side of the table. "Sit down," she said to her husband once more. He moved his plate from one hand to the other, but he kept standing there. It was then she saw puddles of water on the table. She heard water, too. It was dripping off the table and onto the linoleum. She looked down at her husband's bare feet. She stared at his feet next to the pool of water. She knew she'd never again in her life see anything so unusual, but she didn't know what to make of it yet. She thought she'd better put on some lipstick, get her coat, and go ahead to the auction, but she couldn't take her eyes from her husband's feet. She put her plate on the table and watched until the feet left the kitchen and went back to the living room. The Compartment. Myers was traveling through France in a first-class rail car on his way to visit his son in Strasbourg, who was a student at the university there. He hadn't seen the boy in 8 years. There had been no phone calls between them during this time, not even a postcard, since Myers and the boy's mother had gone their separate ways. The boy was staying with her. The final breakup was hastened along, Myers always believed, by the boy's malign interference in their personal affairs. The last time Myers had seen his son, the boy had lunged for him during a violent quarrel. Myers's wife had been standing by the sideboard, dropping one dish of china after the other onto the dining room floor. Then she'd gone on to the cups. "That's enough," Myers had said, and at that instant the boy charged him. Myers sidestepped and got him in a headlock while the boy wept and pummeled Myers on the back and kidneys. Myers had him, and while he had him, he made the most of it. He slammed him into the wall and threatened to kill him. He meant it. "I gave you life," Myers remembered himself shouting, "and I could take it back." Thinking about that horrible scene now, Myers shook his head as if it had happened to someone else. And it had. He was simply not that same person. These days he lived alone and had little to do with anybody outside of his work. At night he listened to classical music and read books on waterfowl decoys. He lit a cigarette and continued to gaze out the train window, ignoring the man who sat in the seat next to the door and who slept with a hat pulled over his eyes. It was early in the morning, and mist hung over the green fields that passed by outside. Now and then, Myers saw a farmhouse and its outbuildings, everything surrounded by a wall. He thought this might be a good way to live, in an old house surrounded by a wall. It was just past 6 o'clock. Myers hadn't slept since he'd boarded the train in Milan at 11 the night before. When the train had left Milan, he'd considered himself lucky to have the compartment to himself. He kept the light on and looked at guidebooks. He read things he wished he'd read before he'd been to the place they were about. He discovered much that he should have seen and done. In a way, he was sorry to be finding out certain things about the country now, just as he was leaving Italy behind after his first, and no doubt last, visit. He put the guidebooks away in his suitcase, put the suitcase in the overhead rack, and took off his coat so he could use it for a blanket. He switched off the light and sat there in the darkened compartment with his eyes closed, hoping sleep would come. After what seemed a long time, and just when he thought he was going to drop off, the train began to slow. It came to a stop at a little station outside of Basel. There, a middle-aged man in a dark suit and wearing a hat entered the compartment. The man said something to Myers in a language Myers didn't understand, and then the man put his leather bag up into the rack. He sat down on the other side of the compartment and straightened his shoulders. Then he pulled his hat over his eyes. By the time the train was moving again, the man was asleep and snoring quietly. Myers envied him. In a few minutes, a Swiss official opened the door of the compartment and turned on the light. In English and in some other language, German, Myers assumed, the official asked to see their passports. The man in the compartment with Myers pushed the hat back on his head, blinked his eyes, and reached into his coat pocket. The official studied the passport, looked at the man closely, and gave him back the document. Myers handed over his own passport. The official read the data, examined the photograph, and then looked at Myers before nodding and giving it back. He turned off the light as he went out. The man across from Myers pulled the hat over his eyes and put out his legs. Myers supposed he'd go right back to sleep, and once again he felt envy. He stayed awake after that and began to think of the meeting with his son, which was now only a few hours away. How would he act when he saw the boy at the station? Should he embrace him? He felt uncomfortable with that prospect. Or should he merely offer his hand, smile as if these 8 years had never occurred, and then pat the boy on the shoulder? Maybe the boy would say a few words. "I'm glad to see you. How was your trip?" And Myers would say something. He really didn't know what he was going to say. The French contrôleur walked by the compartment. He looked in on Myers and at the man sleeping across from Myers. This same contrôleur had already punched their tickets. So Myers turned his head and went back to looking out the window. More houses began to appear, but now there were no walls. And the houses were smaller and set closer together. Soon, Myers was sure, he'd see a French village. The haze was lifting. The train blew its whistle and sped past a crossing over which a barrier had been lowered. He saw a young woman with her hair pinned up and wearing a sweater, standing with her bicycle as she watched the cars whip past. "How's your mother?" he might say to the boy after they had walked a little way from the station. "What do you hear from your mother?" For a wild instant, it occurred to Myers she could be dead, but then he understood that it couldn't be so. He'd have heard something, one way or the other, he'd have heard. He knew if he let himself go on thinking about these things, his heart could break. He closed the top button of his shirt and fixed his tie. He laid his coat across the seat next to him. He laced his shoes, got up, and stepped over the legs of the sleeping man. He let himself out of the compartment. Myers had to put his hand against the windows along the corridor to steady himself as he moved toward the end of the car. He closed the door to the little toilet and locked it. Then he ran water and splashed his face. The train moved into a curve, still at the same high speed, and Myers had to hold on to the sink for balance. The boy's letter had come to him a couple of months ago. The letter had been brief. He wrote that he'd been living in France and studying for the past year at the university in Strasbourg. There was no other information about what had possessed him to go to France, or what he'd been doing with himself during those years before France. Appropriately enough, Myers thought, no mention was made in the letter of the boy's mother, not a clue to her condition or whereabouts. But, inexplicably, the boy had closed the letter with the word love, and Myers had pondered this for a long while. Finally, he'd answered the letter. After some deliberation, Myers wrote to say he had been thinking for some time of making a little trip to Europe. Would the boy like to meet him at the station in Strasbourg? He signed his letter, Love, Dad. He'd heard back from the boy, and then he made his arrangements. It struck him that there was really no one, besides his secretary and a few business associates, that he felt it was necessary to tell he was going away. He had accumulated 6 weeks of vacation at the engineering firm where he worked, and he decided he would take all of the time coming to him for this trip. He was glad he'd done this, even though he now had no intention of spending all that time in Europe. He'd gone first to Rome, but after the first few hours, walking around by himself on the streets, he was sorry he hadn't arranged to be with a group. He was lonely. He went to Venice, a city he and his wife had always talked of visiting. But Venice was a disappointment. He saw a man with one arm eating fried squid, and there were grimy, water-stained buildings everywhere he looked. He took a train to Milan, where he checked into a 4-star hotel and spent the night watching a soccer match on a Sony color TV until the station went off the air. He got up the next morning and wandered around the city until it was time to go to the station. He'd planned the stopover in Strasbourg as the culmination of his trip. After a day or two or 3 days, he'd see how it went. He would travel to Paris and fly home. He was tired of trying to make himself understood to strangers and would be glad to get back. Someone tried the door to the WC. Myers finished tucking his shirt. He fastened his belt. Then he unlocked the door and, swaying with the movement of the train, walked back to his compartment. As he opened the door, he saw at once that his coat had been moved. It lay across a different seat from the one where he'd left it. He felt he had entered into a ludicrous but potentially serious situation. His heart began to race as he picked up the coat. He put his hand into the inside pocket and took out his passport. He carried his wallet in his hip pocket. So he still had his wallet and the passport. He went through the other coat pockets. What was missing was the gift he'd bought for the boy, an expensive Japanese wristwatch purchased at a shop in Rome. He had carried the watch in his inside coat pocket for safekeeping. Now the watch was gone. Pardon, he said to the man who slumped in the seat, legs out, the hat over his eyes. Pardon. The man pushed the hat back and opened his eyes. He pulled himself up and looked at Myers. His eyes were large. He might have been dreaming, but he might not. Myers said, Did you see somebody come in here? But it was clear the man didn't know what Myers was saying. He continued to stare at him with what Myers took to be a look of total incomprehension. But maybe it was something else, Myers thought. Maybe the look masked slyness and deceit. Myers shook his coat to focus the man's attention. Then he put his hand into the pocket and rummaged. He pulled his sleeve back and showed the man his own wristwatch. The man looked at Myers, and then at Myers's watch. He seemed mystified. Myers tapped the face of his watch. He put his other hand back into his coat pocket and made a gesture as if he were fishing for something. Myers pointed at the watch once more and waggled his fingers, hoping to signify the wristwatch taking flight out the door. The man shrugged and shook his head. God damn it, Myers said in frustration. He put his coat on and went out into the corridor. He couldn't stay in the compartment another minute. He was afraid he might strike the man. He looked up and down the corridor, as if hoping he could see and recognize the thief. But there was no one around. Maybe the man who shared his compartment hadn't taken the watch. Maybe someone else, the person who tried the door to the WC, had walked past the compartment, spotted the coat and the sleeping man, and simply opened the door, gone through the pockets, closed the door, and gone away again. Myers walked slowly to the end of the car, peering into the other compartments. It was not crowded in this first-class car, but there were one or two people in each compartment. Most of them were asleep, or seemed to be. Their eyes were closed, and their heads were thrown back against the seats. In one compartment, a man about his own age sat by the window looking out at the countryside. When Myers stopped at the glass and looked in at him, the man turned and regarded him fiercely. Myers crossed into the second-class car. The compartments in this car were crowded, sometimes 5 or 6 passengers in each. And the people, he could tell at a glance, were more desperate. Many of them were awake. It was too uncomfortable to sleep, and they turned their eyes on him as he passed. Foreigners, he thought. It was clear to him that if the man in his compartment hadn't taken the watch, then the thief was from one of these compartments. But what could he do? It was hopeless. The watch was gone. It was in someone else's pocket now. He couldn't hope to make the contrôleur understand what had happened. And even if he could, then what? He made his way back to his own compartment. He looked in and saw that the man had stretched out again with his hat over his eyes. Myers stepped over the man's legs and sat down in his seat by the window. He felt dazed with anger. They were on the outskirts of the city now. Farms and grazing land had given over to industrial plants with unpronounceable names on the fronts of the buildings. The train began slowing. Myers could see automobiles on city streets and others waiting in line at the crossings for the train to pass. He got up and took his suitcase down. He held it on his lap while he looked out the window at this hateful place. It came to him that he didn't want to see the boy after all. He was shocked by this realization, and for a moment felt diminished by the meanness of it. He shook his head. In a lifetime of foolish actions, this trip was possibly the most foolish thing he'd ever done. But the fact was, he really had no desire to see this boy whose behavior had long ago isolated him from Myers's affections. He suddenly, and with great clarity, recalled the boy's face when he had lunged that time, and a wave of bitterness passed over Myers. This boy had devoured Myers's youth, had turned the young girl he had courted and wed into a nervous, alcoholic woman whom the boy alternately pitied and bullied. Why on earth, Myers asked himself, would he come all this way to see someone he disliked? He didn't want to shake the boy's hand, the hand of his enemy, nor have to clap him on the shoulder and make small talk. He didn't want to have to ask him about his mother. He sat forward in the seat as the train pulled into the station. An announcement was called out in French over the train's intercom. The man across from Myers began to stir. He adjusted his hat and sat up in the seat as something else in French came over the speaker. Myers didn't understand anything that was said. He grew more agitated as the train slowed and then came to a stop. He decided he wasn't going to leave the compartment. He was going to sit where he was until the train pulled away. When it did, he'd be on it, going on with the train to Paris, and that would be that. He looked out the window cautiously, afraid he'd see the boy's face at the glass. He didn't know what he'd do if that happened. He was afraid he might shake his fist. He saw a few people on the platform wearing coats and scarves who stood next to their suitcases, waiting to board the train. A few other people waited, without luggage, hands in their pockets, obviously expecting to meet someone. His son was not one of those waiting, but of course that didn't mean he wasn't out there somewhere. Myers moved the suitcase off his lap onto the floor and inched down in his seat. The man across from him was yawning and looking out the window. Now he turned his gaze on Myers. He took off his hat and ran his hand through his hair. Then he put the hat back on, got to his feet, and pulled his bag down from the rack. He opened the compartment door. But before he went out, he turned around and gestured in the direction of the station. Strasbourg, the man said. Myers turned away. The man waited an instant longer, and then went out into the corridor with his bag and, Myers felt certain, with the wristwatch. But that was the least of his concerns now. He looked out the train window once again. He saw a man in an apron standing in the door of the station, smoking a cigarette. The man was watching two trainmen explaining something to a woman in a long skirt who held a baby in her arms. The woman listened and then nodded and listened some more. She moved the baby from one arm to the other. The men kept talking. She listened. One of the men chucked the baby under its chin. The woman looked down and smiled. She moved the baby again and listened some more. Meyer saw a young couple embracing on the platform a little distance from his car. Then the young man let go of the woman. He said something, picked up his valise, and moved to board the train. The woman watched him go. She brought a hand up to her face, touched one eye and then the other with the heel of her hand. In a minute, Meyer saw her moving down the platform, her eyes fixed on his car, as if following someone. He glanced away from the woman and looked at the big clock over the station's waiting room. He looked up and down the platform. The boy was nowhere in sight. It was possible he had overslept, or it might be that he, too, had changed his mind. In any case, Myers felt relieved. He looked at the clock again, then at the young woman who was hurrying up to the window where he sat. Myers drew back as if she were going to strike the glass. The door to the compartment opened. The young man he'd seen outside closed the door behind him and said, "Bonjour." Without waiting for a reply, he threw his valise into the overhead rack and stepped over to the window. "Pardonnez-moi." He pulled the window down. "Marie," he said. The young woman began to smile and cry at the same time. The young man brought her hands up and began kissing her fingers. Myers looked away and clamped his teeth. He heard the final shouts of the trainmen. Someone blew a whistle. Presently, the train began to move away from the platform. The young man had let go of the woman's hands, but he continued to wave at her as the train rolled forward. But the train went only a short distance into the open air of the rail yard, and then Myers felt it come to an abrupt stop. The young man closed the window and moved over to the seat by the door. He took a newspaper from his coat and began to read. Myers got up and opened the door. He went to the end of the corridor where the cars were coupled together. He didn't know why they had stopped. Maybe something was wrong. He moved to the window, but all he could see was an intricate system of tracks where trains were being made up, cars taken off or switched from one train to another. He stepped back from the window. The sign on the door to the next car said, "Pousser." Note, pousser, French, push. End of note. Myers struck the sign with his fist, and the door slid open. He was in the second-class car again. He passed along a row of compartments filled with people settling down, as if making ready for a long trip. He needed to find out from someone where this train was going. He had understood, at the time he purchased the ticket, that the train to Strasbourg went on to Paris, but he felt it would be humiliating to put his head into one of the compartments and say, "Paris?" Or however they said it, as if asking if they'd arrived at a destination. He heard a loud clanking, and the train backed up a little. He could see the station again, and once more he thought of his son. Maybe he was standing back there, breathless from having rushed to get to the station, wondering what had happened to his father. Myers shook his head. The car he was in creaked and groaned under him. Then something caught and fell heavily into place. Myers looked out at the maze of tracks and realized that the train had begun to move again. He turned and hurried back to the end of the car and crossed back into the car he'd been traveling in. He walked down the corridor to his compartment, but the young man with the newspaper was gone, and Myers's suitcase was gone. It was not his compartment after all. He realized with a start they must have uncoupled his car while the train was in the yard and attached another second-class car to the train. The compartment he stood in front of was nearly filled with small, dark-skinned men who spoke rapidly in a language Myers had never heard before. One of the men signaled him to come inside. Myers moved into the compartment, and the men made room for him. There seemed to be a jovial air in the compartment. The man who'd signaled him laughed and patted the space next to him. Myers sat down with his back to the front of the train. The countryside out the window began to pass faster and faster. For a moment, Myers had the impression of the landscape shooting away from him.
He was going somewhere, he knew that. And if it was the wrong direction, sooner or later he'd find it out. He leaned against the seat and closed his eyes. The men went on talking and laughing. Their voices came to him as if from a distance. Soon the voices became part of the train's movements, and gradually, Myers felt himself being carried, then pulled back into sleep. A Small Good Thing. Saturday afternoon, she drove to the bakery in the shopping center. After looking through a loose-leaf binder with photographs of cakes taped onto the pages, she ordered chocolate, the child's favorite. The cake she chose was decorated with a spaceship and launching pad under a sprinkling of white stars and a planet made of red frosting at the other end. His name, Scotty, would be in green letters beneath the planet. The baker, who was an older man with a thick neck, listened without saying anything when she told him the child would be 8 years old next Monday. The baker wore a white apron that looked like a smock. Straps cut under his arms went around in back and then to the front again, where they were secured under his heavy waist. He wiped his hands on his apron as he listened to her. He kept his eyes down on the photographs and let her talk. He let her take her time. He'd just come to work, and he'd be there all night, baking, and he was in no real hurry. She gave the baker her name, Anne Weiss, and her telephone number. The cake would be ready on Monday morning, just out of the oven, in plenty of time for the child's party that afternoon. The baker was not jolly. There were no pleasantries between them, just the minimum exchange of words, the necessary information. He made her feel uncomfortable, and she didn't like that. While he was bent over the counter with the pencil in his hand, she studied his coarse features and wondered if he'd ever done anything else with his life besides be a baker. She was a mother and 33 years old, and it seemed to her that everyone, especially someone the baker's age, a man old enough to be her father, must have children who'd gone through this special time of cakes and birthday parties. There must be that between them, she thought. But he was abrupt with her. Not rude, just abrupt. She gave up trying to make friends with him. She looked into the back of the bakery and could see a long, heavy wooden table with aluminum pie pans stacked at one end. And beside the table, a metal container filled with empty racks. There was an enormous oven. A radio was playing country western music. The baker finished printing the information on the special order card and closed up the binder. He looked at her and said,
Monday morning.
She thanked him and drove home. On Monday morning, the birthday boy was walking to school with another boy. They were passing a bag of potato chips back and forth, and the birthday boy was trying to find out what his friend intended to give him for his birthday that afternoon. Without looking, the birthday boy stepped off the curb at an intersection and was immediately knocked down by a car. He fell on his side with his head in the gutter and his legs out in the road. His eyes were closed, but his legs moved back and forth as if he were trying to climb over something. His friend dropped the potato chips and started to cry. The car had gone 100 feet or so and stopped in the middle of the road. The man in the driver's seat looked back over his shoulder. He waited until the boy got unsteadily to his feet. The boy wobbled a little. He looked dazed but okay. The driver put the car into gear and drove away. The birthday boy didn't cry, but he didn't have anything to say about anything either. He wouldn't answer when his friend asked him what it felt like to be hit by a car. He walked home, and his friend went on to school. But after the birthday boy was inside his house and was telling his mother about it, she sitting beside him on the sofa, holding his hands in her lap, saying, Scotty, honey, are you sure you feel all right, baby? Thinking she would call the doctor anyway, he suddenly lay back on the sofa, closed his eyes, and went limp. When she couldn't wake him up, she hurried to the telephone and called her husband at work. Howard told her to remain calm, and then he called an ambulance for the child and left for the hospital himself. Of course, the birthday party was canceled. The child was in the hospital with a mild concussion and suffering from shock. There'd been vomiting, and his lungs had taken in fluid which needed pumping out that afternoon.
Now he simply seemed to be in a very deep sleep. But no coma, Dr. Francis had emphasized, no coma, when he saw the alarm in the parents' eyes. At 11 o'clock that night, when the boy seemed to be resting comfortably enough after the many x-rays and the lab work, and it was just a matter of his waking up and coming around, Howard left the hospital. He and Anne had been at the hospital with the child since that afternoon, and he was going home for a short while to bathe and change clothes.
I'll be back in an hour, he said.
She nodded. It's fine, she said. I'll be right here. He kissed her on the forehead and they touched hands. She sat in the chair beside the bed and looked at the child. She was waiting for him to wake up and be all right. Then she could begin to relax. Howard drove home from the hospital. He took the wet, dark streets very fast, then caught himself and slowed down. Until now, his life had gone smoothly and to his satisfaction. College, marriage, another year of college for the advanced degree in business, a junior partnership in an investment firm, fatherhood. He was happy and, so far, lucky, he knew that. His parents were still living. His brothers and his sister were established. His friends from college had gone out to take their places in the world. So far, he had kept away from any real harm, from those forces he knew existed and that could cripple or bring down a man if the luck went bad, if things suddenly turned. He pulled into the driveway and parked. His left leg began to tremble. He sat in the car for a minute and tried to deal with the present situation in a rational manner. Scotty had been hit by a car and was in the hospital, but he was going to be all right. Howard closed his eyes and ran his hand over his face. He got out of the car and went up to the front door. The dog was barking inside the house. The telephone rang and rang while he unlocked the door and fumbled for the light switch. He shouldn't have left the hospital. He shouldn't have. God damn it, he said. He picked up the receiver and said, I just walked in the door.
There's a cake here that wasn't picked up,
the voice on the other end of the line said.
What are you saying?
Howard asked.
A cake, the voice said. A $16 cake.
Howard held the receiver against his ear, trying to understand.
I don't know anything about a cake, he said. Jesus, what are you talking about? Don't hand me that, the voice said.
Howard hung up the telephone. He went into the kitchen and poured himself some whiskey. He called the hospital. But the child's condition remained the same. He was still sleeping, and nothing had changed there. While water poured into the tub, Howard lathered his face and shaved. He'd just stretched out in the tub and closed his eyes when the telephone rang again. He hauled himself out, grabbed a towel, and hurried through the house saying, stupid, stupid, for having left the hospital. But when he picked up the receiver and shouted, hello, there was no sound at the other end of the line. Then the caller hung up. He arrived back at the hospital a little after midnight. Anne still sat in the chair beside the bed. She looked up at Howard, and then she looked back at the child. The child's eyes stayed closed. The head was still wrapped in bandages. His breathing was quiet and regular. From an apparatus over the bed hung a bottle of glucose with a tube running from the bottle to the boy's arm.
How is he?
Howard said.
What's all this?
Waving at the glucose and the tube. Dr. Francis's orders, she said. He needs nourishment. He needs to keep up his strength. Why doesn't he wake up, Howard? I don't understand if he's all right. Howard put his hand against the back of her head. He ran his fingers through her hair.
He's going to be all right. He'll wake up in a little while. Dr. Francis knows what's what.
After a time, he said,
maybe you should go home and get some rest. I'll stay here. Just don't put up with this creep who keeps calling. Hang up right away.
Who's calling? She asked.
I don't know who, just somebody with nothing better to do than call up people. You go on now.
She shook her head. No, she said. I'm fine.
Really? He said. Go home for a while, and then come back and spell me in the morning. It'll be all right. What did Dr. Francis say? He said Scotty's going to be all right. We don't have to worry. He's just sleeping now, that's all.
A nurse pushed the door open. She nodded at them as she went to the bedside. She took the left arm out from under the covers and put her fingers on the wrist, found the pulse, then consulted her watch. In a little while, she put the arm back under the covers and moved to the foot of the bed, where she wrote something on a clipboard attached to the bed.
"How is he?"
Anne said. Howard's hand was a weight on her shoulder. She was aware of the pressure from his fingers.
"He's stable,"
the nurse said. Then she said,
"Doctor will be in again shortly.
Doctor's back in the hospital. He's making rounds right now."
"I was saying maybe she'd want to go home and get a little rest," Howard said. "After the doctor comes," he said.
"She could do that," the nurse said. "I think you should both feel free to do that if you wish." The nurse was a big Scandinavian woman with blonde hair. There was a trace of an accent in her speech.
"We'll see what the doctor says," Anne said. "I want to talk to the doctor. I don't think he should keep sleeping like this. I don't think that's a good sign."
She brought her hand up to her eyes and let her head come forward a little. Howard's grip tightened on her shoulder, and then his hand moved up to her neck, where his fingers began to knead the muscles there.
"Dr. Francis will be here in a few minutes," the nurse said. Then she left the room.
Howard gazed at his son for a time, the small chest quietly rising and falling under the covers. For the first time since the terrible minutes after Anne's telephone call to him at his office, he felt a genuine fear starting in his limbs. He began shaking his head. Scotty was fine. But instead of sleeping at home in his own bed, he was in a hospital bed with bandages around his head and a tube in his arm. But this help was what he needed right now. Dr. Francis came in and shook hands with Howard, though they'd just seen each other a few hours before. Anne got up from the chair.
"Doctor?"
"Anne," he said and nodded.
"Let's just first see how he's doing," the doctor said.
He moved to the side of the bed and took the boy's pulse. He peeled back one eyelid and then the other. Howard and Anne stood beside the doctor and watched. Then the doctor turned back the covers and listened to the boy's heart and lungs with his stethoscope. He pressed his fingers here and there on the abdomen. When he was finished, he went to the end of the bed and studied the chart. He noted the time, scribbled something on the chart, and then looked at Howard and Anne.
"Doctor, how is he?"
Howard said.
"What's the matter with him exactly?"
"Why doesn't he wake up?" Anne said. The doctor was a handsome, big-shouldered man with a tanned face. He wore a three-piece blue suit, a striped tie, and ivory cufflinks. His gray hair was combed along the sides of his head, and he looked as if he had just come from a concert.
"He's all right," the doctor said. "Nothing to shout about. He could be better, I think. But he's all right. Still, I wish he'd wake up. He should wake up pretty soon."
The doctor looked at the boy again.
"We'll know some more in a couple of hours, after the results of a few more tests are in. But he's all right, believe me, except for the hairline fracture of the skull. He does have that."
"Oh, no," Anne said.
"And a bit of a concussion, as I said before. Of course, you know he's in shock,"
the doctor said.
"Sometimes you see this in shock cases. This sleeping."
"But he's out of any real danger?" Howard said. "You said before he's not in a coma. You wouldn't call this a coma then, would you, doctor?"
Howard waited. He looked at the doctor.
"No, I don't want to call it a coma,"
the doctor said and glanced over at the boy once more.
"He's just in a very deep sleep. It's a restorative measure the body is taking on its own. He's out of any real danger, I'd say that for certain, yes. But we'll know more when he wakes up and the other tests are in,"
the doctor said.
"It's a coma," Anne said, "of sorts."
"It's not a coma yet, not exactly," the doctor said. "I wouldn't want to call it a coma, not yet anyway. He's suffered shock. In shock cases, this kind of reaction is common enough. It's a temporary reaction to bodily trauma. Coma. Well, coma is a deep, prolonged unconsciousness. Something that could go on for days or weeks, even. Scotty's not in that area, not as far as we can tell. I'm certain his condition will show improvement by morning. I'm betting that it will. We'll know more when he wakes up, which shouldn't be long now. Of course, you may do as you like, stay here or go home for a time, but by all means, feel free to leave the hospital for a while if you want. This is not easy, I know.
The doctor gazed at the boy again, watching him, and then he turned to Anne and said,
You try not to worry, little mother. Believe me, we're doing all that can be done. It's just a question of a little more time now.
He nodded at her, shook hands with Howard again, and then he left the room. Anne put her hand over the child's forehead. At least he doesn't have a fever, she said. Then she said, My God, he feels so cold, though. Howard, is he supposed to feel like this? Feel his head. Howard touched the child's temples. His own breathing had slowed.
I think he's supposed to feel this way right now, he said. He's in shock, remember? That's what the doctor said. The doctor was just in here. He would have said something if Scotty wasn't okay.
Anne stood there a while longer, working her lip with her teeth. Then she moved over to her chair and sat down. Howard sat in the chair next to her chair. They looked at each other. He wanted to say something else and reassure her, but he was afraid, too. He took her hand and put it in his lap, and this made him feel better, her hand being there. He picked up her hand and squeezed it. Then he just held her hand. They sat like that for a while, watching the boy and not talking. From time to time, he squeezed her hand. Finally, she took her hand away. I've been praying, she said. He nodded. She said, I almost thought I'd forgotten how, but it came back to me. All I had to do was close my eyes and say, Please, God, help us. Help Scotty. And then the rest was easy. The words were right there. Maybe if you prayed too, she said to him.
I've already prayed, he said. I prayed this afternoon, yesterday afternoon, I mean, after you called, while I was driving to the hospital. I've been praying, he said.
That's good, she said. For the first time, she felt they were together in it, this trouble. She realized with a start that, until now, it had only been happening to her and to Scotty. She hadn't let Howard into it, though he was there and needed all along. She felt glad to be his wife. The same nurse came in and took the boy's pulse again and checked the flow from the bottle hanging above the bed. In an hour, another doctor came in. He said his name was Parsons from radiology. He had a bushy mustache. He was wearing loafers, a western shirt, and a pair of jeans.
We're going to take him downstairs for more pictures, he told them. We need to do some more pictures, and we want to do a scan.
What's that? Anne said. A scan? She stood between this new doctor and the bed. I thought you'd already taken all your x-rays.
I'm afraid we need some more, he said. Nothing to be alarmed about. We just need some more pictures, and we want to do a brain scan on him.
My God, Anne said.
It's perfectly normal procedure in cases like this, this new doctor said. We just need to find out for sure why he isn't back awake yet. It's normal medical procedure and nothing to be alarmed about. We'll be taking him down in a few minutes, this doctor said.
In a little while, two orderlies came into the room with a gurney. They were black-haired, dark-complexioned men in white uniforms, and they said a few words to each other in a foreign tongue as they unhooked the boy from the tube and moved him from his bed to the gurney. Then they wheeled him from the room. Howard and Anne got on the same elevator. Anne gazed at the child. She closed her eyes as the elevator began its descent. The orderlies stood at either end of the gurney without saying anything, though once one of the men made a comment to the other in their own language and the other men nodded slowly in response. Later that morning, just as the sun was beginning to lighten the windows in the waiting room outside the x-ray department, they brought the boy out and moved him back up to his room. Howard and Anne rode up on the elevator with him once more, and once more they took up their places beside the bed. They waited all day, but still the boy did not wake up. Occasionally, one of them would leave the room to go downstairs to the cafeteria to drink coffee and then, as if suddenly remembering and feeling guilty, get up from the table and hurry back to the room. Dr. Francis came again that afternoon and examined the boy once more, and then left after telling them he was coming along and could wake up at any minute now. Nurses, different nurses from the night before, came in from time to time. Then a young woman from the lab knocked and entered the room. She wore white slacks and a white blouse and carried a little tray of things which she put on the stand beside the bed. Without a word to them, she took blood from the boy's arm. Howard closed his eyes as the woman found the right place on the boy's arm and pushed the needle in. "I don't understand this," Anne said to the woman. "Doctor's orders," the young woman said. "I do what I'm told. They say draw that one, I draw." "What's wrong with him anyway?" she said. "He's a sweetie."
"He was hit by a car," Howard said. "A hit and run."
The young woman shook her head and looked again at the boy. Then she took her tray and left the room. "Why won't he wake up?" Anne said. "Howard, I want some answers from these people." Howard didn't say anything. He sat down again in the chair and crossed one leg over the other. He rubbed his face. He looked at his son, and then he settled back in the chair, closed his eyes, and went to sleep. Anne walked to the window and looked out at the parking lot. It was night, and cars were driving into and out of the parking lot with their lights on. She stood at the window with her hands gripping the sill and knew in her heart that they were into something now, something hard. She was afraid, and her teeth began to chatter until she tightened her jaws. She saw a big car stop in front of the hospital and someone, a woman in a long coat, get into the car. She wished she were that woman, and somebody, anybody, was driving her away from here to somewhere else, a place where she would find Scotty waiting for her when she stepped out of the car, ready to say "Mom" and let her gather him in her arms. In a little while, Howard woke up. He looked at the boy again. Then he got up from the chair, stretched, and went over to stand beside her at the window. They both stared out at the parking lot. They didn't say anything, but they seemed to feel each other's insides now, as though the worry had made them transparent in a perfectly natural way. The door opened and Dr. Francis came in. He was wearing a different suit and tie this time. His gray hair was combed along the sides of his head, and he looked as if he had just shaved. He went straight to the bed and examined the boy.
"He ought to have come around by now. There's just no good reason for this," he said. "But I can tell you we're all convinced he's out of any danger. We'll just feel better when he wakes up. There's no reason, absolutely none, why he shouldn't come around. Very soon. Oh, he'll have himself a dilly of a headache when he does, you can count on that. But all of his signs are fine. They're as normal as can be."
"It is a coma, then," Anne said. The doctor rubbed his smooth cheek.
"We'll call it that for the time being, until he wakes up. But you must be worn out. This is hard. I know this is hard. Feel free to go out for a bite," he said. "It would do you good. I'll put a nurse in here while you're gone if you'll feel better about going. Go and have yourself something to eat."
"I couldn't eat anything," Anne said.
"Do what you need to do, of course," the doctor said. "Anyway, I wanted to tell you that all the signs are good. The tests are negative, nothing showed up at all, and just as soon as he wakes up, he'll be over the hill."
"Thank you, doctor," Howard said.
He shook hands with the doctor again. The doctor patted Howard's shoulder and went out.
"I suppose one of us should go home and check on things," Howard said. "Slug needs to be fed for one thing."
"Call one of the neighbors," Anne said. "Call the Morgans. Anyone will feed a dog if you ask them to."
"All right," Howard said.
After a while, he said,
"Honey, why don't you do it? Why don't you go home and check on things and then come back? It'll do you good. I'll be right here with him, seriously," he said. "We need to keep up our strength on this. We'll want to be here for a while, even after he wakes up." Why don't you go? She said. Feed, Slug. Feed yourself.
I already went, he said. I was gone for exactly 1 hour and 15 minutes. You go home for 1 hour and freshen up, then come back.
She tried to think about it, but she was too tired. She closed her eyes and tried to think about it again. After a time, she said, maybe I will go home for a few minutes. Maybe if I'm not just sitting right here watching him every second, he'll wake up and be all right, you know? Maybe he'll wake up if I'm not here. I'll go home and take a bath and put on clean clothes. I'll feed Slug. Then I'll come back.
I'll be right here, he said. You go on home, honey. I'll keep an eye on things here.
His eyes were bloodshot and small, as if he'd been drinking for a long time. His clothes were rumpled. His beard had come out again. She touched his face, and then she took her hand back. She understood he wanted to be by himself for a while, not have to talk or share his worry for a time. She picked her purse up from the nightstand, and he helped her into the coat. I won't be gone long, she said.
Just sit and rest for a while when you get home, he said. Eat something. Take a bath. After you get out of the bath, just sit for a while and rest. It'll do you a world of good, you'll see. Then come back, he said. Let's try not to worry. You heard what Dr. Francis said.
She stood in her coat for a minute, trying to recall the doctor's exact words, looking for any nuances, any hint of something behind his words other than what he had said. She tried to remember if his expression had changed any when he bent over to examine the child. She remembered the way his features had composed themselves as he rolled back the child's eyelids and then listened to his breathing. She went to the door, where she turned and looked back. She looked at the child, and then she looked at the father. Howard nodded. She stepped out of the room and pulled the door closed behind her. She went past the nurse's station and down to the end of the corridor, looking for the elevator. At the end of the corridor, she turned to her right and entered a little waiting room where a Negro family sat in wicker chairs. There was a middle-aged man in a khaki shirt and pants, a baseball cap pushed back on his head. A large woman wearing a house dress and slippers was slumped in one of the chairs. A teenaged girl in jeans, hair done in dozens of little braids, lay stretched out in one of the chairs smoking a cigarette, her legs crossed at the ankles. The family swung their eyes to Anne as she entered the room. The little table was littered with hamburger wrappers and styrofoam cups. Franklin, the large woman said as she roused herself. Is it about Franklin? Her eyes widened. Tell me now, lady, the woman said. Is it about Franklin? She was trying to rise from her chair, but the man had closed his hand over her arm.
Here, here, he said. Evelyn.
I'm sorry, Anne said. I'm looking for the elevator. My son is in the hospital, and now I can't find the elevator.
Elevator is down that way. Turn left, the man said as he aimed a finger.
The girl drew on her cigarette and stared at Anne. Her eyes were narrowed to slits, and her broad lips parted slowly as she let the smoke escape. The Negro woman let her head fall on her shoulder and looked away from Anne, no longer interested. My son was hit by a car, Anne said to the man. She seemed to need to explain herself. He has a concussion and a little skull fracture, but he's going to be all right. He's in shock now, but it might be some kind of coma, too. That's what really worries us, the coma part. I'm going out for a little while, but my husband is with him. Maybe he'll wake up while I'm gone.
That's too bad,
the man said and shifted in the chair. He shook his head. He looked down at the table, and then he looked back at Anne. She was still standing there. He said,
Oh, Franklin, he's on the operating table. Somebody cut him, tried to kill him. There was a fight where he was at this party. They say he was just standing and watching, not bothering nobody. But that'll mean nothing these days. Now he's on the operating table. We're just hoping and praying. That's all we can do now.
He gazed at her steadily.
Anne looked at the girl again, who was still watching her, and at the older woman who kept her head down, but whose eyes were now closed. Anne saw the lips moving silently, making words. She had an urge to ask what those words were. She wanted to talk more with these people who were in the same kind of waiting she was in. She was afraid, and they were afraid. They had that in common. She would have liked to have said something else about the accident, told them more about Scotty, that it had happened on the day of his birthday, Monday, and that he was still unconscious. Yet she didn't know how to begin. She stood looking at them without saying anything more. She went down the corridor the man had indicated and found the elevator. She waited a minute in front of the closed doors, still wondering if she was doing the right thing. Then she put out her finger and touched the button. She pulled into the driveway and cut the engine. She closed her eyes and leaned her head against the wheel for a minute. She listened to the ticking sounds the engine made as it began to cool. Then she got out of the car. She could hear the dog barking inside the house. She went to the front door, which was unlocked. She went inside and turned on lights and put on a kettle of water for tea. She opened some dog food and fed Slug on the back porch. The dog ate in hungry little smacks. It kept running into the kitchen to see that she was going to stay. As she sat down on the sofa with her tea, the telephone rang. "Yes," she said as she answered. "Hello."
"Mrs. Weiss,"
a man's voice said. It was 5 o'clock in the morning, and she thought she could hear machinery or equipment of some kind in the background.
"Yes, yes, what is it?" she said. "This is Mrs. Weiss. This is she. What is it, please?"
She listened to whatever it was in the background.
"Is it Scotty, for Christ's sake?"
"Scotty," the man's voice said. "It's about Scotty, yes. It has to do with Scotty, that problem. Have you forgotten about Scotty?"
the man said. Then he hung up. She dialed the hospital's number and asked for the third floor. She demanded information about her son from the nurse who answered the telephone. Then she asked to speak to her husband. It was, she said, an emergency. She waited, turning the telephone cord in her fingers. She closed her eyes and felt sick at her stomach. She would have to make herself eat. Slug came in from the back porch and lay down near her feet. He wagged his tail. She pulled at his ear while he licked her fingers. Howard was on the line.
"Somebody just called here," she said.
She twisted the telephone cord.
"He said it was about Scotty," she cried.
"Scotty's fine," Howard told her. "I mean, he's still sleeping. There's been no change. The nurse has been in twice since you've been gone. A nurse or else a doctor. He's all right."
"This man called. He said it was about Scotty," she told him.
"Honey, you rest for a little while. You need the rest. It must be that same caller I had. Just forget it. Come back down here after you've rested. Then we'll have breakfast or something."
"Breakfast," she said.
"I don't want any breakfast." "You know what I mean," he said. "Juice, something. I don't know. I don't know anything, Anne. Jesus, I'm not hungry either. Anne, it's hard to talk now. I'm standing here at the desk. Dr. Francis is coming again at 8 o'clock this morning. He's going to have something to tell us then, something more definite. That's what one of the nurses said. She didn't know any more than that. Anne? Honey, maybe we'll know something more then. At 8 o'clock. Come back here before 8. Meanwhile, I'm right here and Scotty's all right. He's still the same," he added.
"I was drinking a cup of tea," she said, "when the telephone rang. They said it was about Scotty. There was a noise in the background. Was there a noise in the background on that call you had, Howard?"
"I don't remember," he said. "Maybe the driver of the car, maybe he's a psychopath and found out about Scotty somehow. But I'm here with him. Just rest like you were going to do. Take a bath and come back by 7 or so, and we'll talk to the doctor together when he gets here. It's going to be all right, honey. I'm here, and there are doctors and nurses around. They say his condition is stable."
"I'm scared to death," she said.
She ran water, undressed, and got into the tub. She washed and dried quickly, not taking the time to wash her hair. She put on clean underwear, wool slacks, and a sweater. She went into the living room where the dog looked up at her and let its tail thump once against the floor. It was just starting to get light outside when she went out to the car. She drove into the parking lot of the hospital and found a space close to the front door. She felt she was in some obscure way responsible for what had happened to the child. She let her thoughts move to the Negro family. She remembered the name Franklin and the table that was covered with hamburger papers and the teenaged girl staring at her as she drew on her cigarette. "Don't have children," she told the girl's image as she entered the front door of the hospital. "For God's sake, don't." She took the elevator up to the third floor with two nurses who were just going on duty. It was Wednesday morning, a few minutes before 7. There was a page for a Dr. Madison as the elevator doors slid open on the third floor. She got off behind the nurses, who turned in the other direction and continued the conversation she had interrupted when she'd gotten into the elevator. She walked down the corridor to the little alcove where the Negro family had been waiting. They were gone now, but the chairs were scattered in such a way that it looked as if people had just jumped up from them the minute before. The tabletop was cluttered with the same cups and papers. The ashtray was filled with cigarette butts. She stopped at the nurse's station. A nurse was standing behind the counter, brushing her hair and yawning. "There was a Negro boy in surgery last night," Anne said. "Franklin was his name. His family was in the waiting room. I'd like to inquire about his condition." A nurse who was sitting at a desk behind the counter looked up from a chart in front of her. The telephone buzzed and she picked up the receiver, but she kept her eyes on Anne. "He passed away," said the nurse at the counter. The nurse held the hairbrush and kept looking at her. "Are you a friend of the family or what?"
"I met the family last night," Anne said. "My own son is in the hospital. I guess he's in shock. We don't know for sure what's wrong. I just wondered about Franklin, that's all. Thank you."
She moved down the corridor. Elevator doors the same color as the walls slid open, and a gaunt, bald man in white pants and white canvas shoes pulled a heavy cart off the elevator. She hadn't noticed these doors last night. The man wheeled the cart out into the corridor and stopped in front of the room nearest the elevator and consulted a clipboard. Then he reached down and slid a tray out of the cart. He rapped lightly on the door and entered the room. She could smell the unpleasant odors of warm food as she passed the cart. She hurried on without looking at any of the nurses and pushed open the door to the child's room. Howard was standing at the window with his hands behind his back. He turned around as she came in. "How is he?" she said. She went over to the bed. She dropped her purse on the floor beside the nightstand. It seemed to her she had been gone a long time. She touched the child's face. "Howard?"
"Dr. Francis was here a little while ago," Howard said.
She looked at him closely and thought his shoulders were bunched a little. "I thought he wasn't coming until 8 o'clock this morning," she said quickly.
"There was another doctor with him, a neurologist."
"A neurologist," she said. Howard nodded. His shoulders were bunching, she could see that. "What'd they say, Howard? For Christ's sake, what'd they say? What is it?"
"They said they're going to take him down and run more tests on him, Anne. They think they're going to operate, honey." "Honey, they are going to operate. They can't figure out why he won't wake up. It's more than just shock or concussion. They know that much now. It's in his skull, the fracture. It has something to do with that, they think. So they're going to operate. I tried to call you, but I guess you'd already left the house."
"Oh, God," she said. "Oh, please, Howard, please," she said, taking his arms.
"Look," Howard said.
"Scotty, look, Anne."
He turned her toward the bed.
The boy had opened his eyes, then closed them. He opened them again now. The eyes stared straight ahead for a minute, then moved slowly in his head until they rested on Howard and Anne, then traveled away again. "Scotty," his mother said, moving to the bed.
"Hey, Scott," his father said. "Hey, son."
They leaned over the bed. Howard took the child's hand in his hands and began to pat and squeeze the hand. Anne bent over the boy and kissed his forehead again and again. She put her hands on either side of his face. "Scotty, honey, it's Mommy and Daddy," she said. "Scotty?" The boy looked at them, but without any sign of recognition. Then his mouth opened, his eyes scrunched closed, and he howled until he had no more air in his lungs. His face seemed to relax and soften then. His lips parted as his last breath was puffed through his throat and exhaled gently through the clenched teeth. The doctors called it a hidden occlusion and said it was a one-in-a-million circumstance. Maybe if it could have been detected somehow and surgery undertaken immediately, they could have saved him, but more than likely not. In any case, what would they have been looking for? Nothing had shown up in the tests or in the x-rays. Dr. Francis was shaken.
"I can't tell you how badly I feel. I'm so very sorry I can't tell you,"
he said as he led them into the doctor's lounge. There was a doctor sitting in a chair with his legs hooked over the back of another chair, watching an early morning TV show. He was wearing a green delivery room outfit, loose green pants and green blouse, and a green cap that covered his hair. He looked at Howard and Anne and then looked at Dr. Francis. He got to his feet and turned off the set and went out of the room. Dr. Francis guided Anne to the sofa, sat down beside her, and began to talk in a low, consoling voice. At one point, he leaned over and embraced her. She could feel his chest rising and falling evenly against her shoulder. She kept her eyes open and let him hold her. Howard went into the bathroom, but he left the door open. After a violent fit of weeping, he ran water and washed his face. Then he came out and sat down at the little table that held a telephone. He looked at the telephone as though deciding what to do first. He made some calls. After a time, Dr. Francis used the telephone.
"Is there anything else I can do for the moment?"
he asked them. Howard shook his head.